everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Dream Big Podcast with Bob Goff and friends. This is your co-host, Scott Schimmel, and I'm joined across the internet with Bob Goff.
Hey, everyone. I hope you've had a week that has been both memorable and one that actually you feel a sense of presence. There's a saying in the South, be where your feet are. And so I know that during these really difficult times, it's easy to get distracted, it's easy to get impatient, but no better remedy than to meet a new friend. And John Richmond is a guy that you want to get to know.
Yeah, this month we're talking about how do you dream big for the world. And John is a guy that's not just dreaming big for the world, with a tremendous track record of fighting for justice, but he's also a guy that dreams big for his family, and he's doing both. His formal title is U.S. Ambassador at Large to Monitor and Combat Trafficking in Persons. In other words, he is the U.S. Ambassador to fight against human trafficking. He is a stud. And what you're going to listen to is a tremendous conversation between Bob and a really close friend, John. Talk about how do you fight for justice and build a really healthy family.
I think that's a great way. You have the long title and his business card is 5 feet long, or you could just have the short title, just says stud. John is a kind guy, and you're going to hear that through his words. He's a wise man. He is one of my dear friends. And I just wanted you to hear, during a time that we're talking about things around the world, from somebody who's literally making moves around the world. Listen in for a conversation with John. Hey, everybody. I'm with a great friend of many years, John Richmond. John, how long have we known each other for?
Bob, we've known each other since 2003 when you first visited India.
Is that crazy? Who gets to say that? We had these kids that were really young, and I wanted them to meet some of the people that were doing the important work of justice. I was a lawyer, but I wanted them to meet people that weren't just practicing law, but doing justice. And so we headed to India. Well, can you give us some context? What were you doing in India at the time?
Oh my goodness. So my wife and I had just arrived in India with our 15-month-old daughter. My wife was actually pregnant with our second child when we landed. And we knew absolutely nothing about how to actually deal with human trafficking. I had never met a trafficking victim. I'd never met a trafficker, but I'd been practicing law for a while, and this young NGO called International Justice Mission was looking for a lawyer to go to India and start its forced labor work. And so we did. And in fact, when you all visited me, we were in this odd little upper story of a house in a bad part of town where a few of us had gathered. We had begun to build a team, and we were thinking about this idea of freedom. And could people actually be free? And it was so fun and encouraging to have you and your two older kids at the time. I don't think Adam was quite old enough to come on the journey. Come and spend a week with us and begin to think about these ideas.
Yeah, and one of the things that I'd encourage as you're listening to John's story about justice and where this has led him on his adventure is to take your kids on theirs, to include the people. I'm not positive about a bunch of stuff, but I'm positive about my family. And
absolutely.
So to expose them and then find really kind people along the way that will make your kids feel welcomed. And even though it was a long distance to travel, when they got there, you just immediately made them feel welcome in kind of a place where there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of unknowns. I know when it came to this pregnancy that was not an easy delivery. I mean, that was pretty harrowing for you guys.
You know, it really was. And I think that what folks don't anticipate is the number of setbacks that are going to come once we start on a journey. You know, once we chose to go to India and live there as a family, I think most people just anticipated that we'd get there and things would sort of unfold naturally and it would all go well. And it didn't go well. Like things from a substantive standpoint weren't going well in terms of the office. A lot of starts and stops in terms of getting that going, but also didn't go well in terms of the delivery. My wife almost died. It was really harrowing. In fact, I remember so clearly the evening after she delivered our son. He was fine, but she was not. The doctors pulled me aside, and they said, she's probably not going to make it through the night, and you need to figure out what you're going to do with the baby. And I remember walking out into this hospital hallway halfway across the world from anything that was familiar to me. And it was dark and it was quiet and it had that smell that hospitals seem to have. And I felt further away from community and everything I'd ever known. And I began this dialogue with with God, thinking like we came here to do this great work. You know, everyone told us that we didn't know what we were doing and we'd fail. Now it's all going to seem like they were right. Like, what is going on? I began to pray, like, she deserves to live. She deserves it. And if anyone, I get this cool job. I get to kind of bust down doors and catch bad guys and bring justice to the oppressed. But she could be a mom and an educator anywhere. Like, she was so faithful. She should deserve to come. And I felt so clearly a lesson being taught to me in that moment that, no, we don't deserve anything. We don't get any sort of spiritual brownie points by doing the right thing. We're not entitled to any sort of blessing. God's not a vending machine in which we insert our token of obedience and then take out our gift of choice. It's not about us. That God wants these people to be free because he made them and he loves them and he can use us. And fortunately, you know, she did make it through that night and then through the next several weeks, and she was sick for months, but slowly got better. And during that time, it just became very consistent on the beginning of our justice journey that this is not about us. It's not about how smart we are, how witty we are, how creative, how skilled. This is all about him. And it was a great lesson to learn at the beginning of our journey.
You guys, as you're listening, you're going to get some pushback. You have some ambitions and some dreams. You do something, you're jumping the tracks because you don't want to end up in the same place. You want to do end up in the same place, ride the monorail at Disneyland. You always go to the same stops, same place. But if you want to live your life, it means jumping the tracks. And so when John jumped the tracks, now he's in another country. He's got a wife that might die. He's got a newborn and an infant. And it's really hard to not say, God, what the heck? I thought I was doing these things. So I just want to be a reminder that if we want to make great change, it's going to involve great risk. And we don't need to aim for risk. What we need to do is kind of live into that. And then when there's a lot of ambiguity, a big dollop of ambiguity that gets put on your dream, to say, what do you do next? Tell us from there what happened. You ended up in India for a bit, and then, and crazy thing, you could have worked at any law firm you wanted. You're too modest to say, but just trust me, he could have gone any law firm he wanted, but he said, let me go serve the poor. You did that for a number of years in India. We became friends. And then a change back to Washington, D.C. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was an incredible opportunity. We had been working in India for a little over 3 years. The human trafficking community is a fairly small subculture, certainly was back then in the early days. There was an opportunity to come to the U.S. Department of Justice to found the Human Trafficking Prosecution Unit along with a bunch of other prosecutors within the Civil Rights Division and really think about how we could advance this idea of freedom with labor trafficking victims as well as sex trafficking victims in the United States. And I have to tell you, I was hesitant. You know, after 3 years in India, we had figured it out. We even had a beef bootlegger. We had someone that would actually bring us cow meat in a brown paper bag and sneak it to us. Like, we had gamed and hacked all the systems of India. I will tell you that cows that eat trash taste different than cows that eat grass. But it was fun.
And not lightly massaged. So, yeah.
Things were going well. We had built an office. We were seeing success. Things had grown. And I think I could have lived in India forever. But I think my wife realized that as well. And so when this opportunity to come back to the Department of Justice came up, she thought we should take it. I was uncertain. And I realized that that we go together. And the fact that she was ready to leave India, even though we were thriving at that point, that meant it was time to go without any sort of guilt, without any manipulation, without any sort of hesitation. And so the ride in India had ended, and we came back to the U.S., and I was completely uncertain about what would come. And she was incredibly insightful. She said, this is the beginning of something bigger. And I'm thinking, nope, the biggest thing was behind us in India. This will just be a regular job.
Is that crazy? Kind of, want to, we all have this reaction. We want to return to what we know the best because there is some safety in that. And even if it isn't entirely safe and your circumstance wasn't, at least it was pretty well known. Yet, all the way through the scriptures, they were saying, you know, like Abraham's telling Sarah, we're going. And she's like, where? But like, I can't say. That's what Jesus said to all the disciples with him. Where are we going? Be like, I can't say.
You know, when we got back to the United States, it was the hardest transition we've ever had. It was much easier to go to India than it was to come to Washington, D.C.
Really?
Toughest 2 years of our marriage, hands down, were those first 2 years.
Is it the whiplash of just of cultures, or what was it that made that hard?
I think it was a couple of things. One, it was in India, everyone's on top of each other. We knew our neighbors so well because we're all on the roof every night because that was the only cool place to gather. And so you know what's going on in each other's lives. We got to Washington, D.C., we got our little townhouse, and we never saw our neighbors. I would strategically like time when I would go to the mailbox so I could meet somebody. Everybody's just so busy. And finding community, building that out was a challenge. We had some other challenges as well. My wife was finishing her master's program. I began traveling a great deal for these cases all over the country. But fortunately, we were able to fight through that. We were able to work and just continue to love each other as we made that transition to love our kids. Spent a decade at the Civil Rights Division prosecuting human trafficking cases all over the country. It was an incredible privilege. Some of the most marquee cases that the country has had.
I don't know what you can share about some of those cases, but I'm aware of some of the things that you were doing. It was blowing my mind. I'm like, you're that guy?
You know, it's one of those moments when you realize this is what every kid that starts law school wishes they got to do.
Heck yeah.
My first federal trial was a cross-burning case to an all-white jury in Arkansas. Then I got to try the leader of the largest neo-Nazi organization in the U.S. because we did hate crimes as well. But as we founded the Human Trafficking Prosecution Unit and began to specialize on just trafficking cases, got to prosecute large labor trafficking cases as well as some really painful sex trafficking cases in New York and Chicago and New Orleans, working in L.A., in Kansas, a restaurant where they were forcing Indian men to work, all sorts of cases from all over the country, and realizing that there was a common theme, that there are a group of individuals out there of women and men who want to exploit others for profit. They want to enrich themselves by diminishing others' freedom. And I think that it's just so important to know that there are millions of people. The UN estimates 24.9 million people in the world today who don't get to make the most basic decisions about their lives. Someone else is deciding when they wake up, where they work, and who touches their bodies. And that's just not right because everyone has inherent value. Everyone has human dignity. And to get to stand up and try to advance this idea of stopping traffickers, protecting victims, and then changing systems so that it's more difficult for traffickers to operate seemed like a fantastic way to practice law.
You're a man of many really notable attributes and interests. While you're doing these things, you're also dad. You're also husband. I know your family just means the world. So how did you navigate doing these great big things in justice and then at the same time pulling off being dad? I know you've came up with some kind of rules for the Richmonds. Can you give us just a quick overview of those? Blew my mind.
Oh, it's so much fun because we just immediately dispense with the idea of having balance. Balance is a terrible concept, I think, because it's so hard to maintain your balance. A friend of mine got one of these balance boards where you're supposed to stay, and it's just so hard. Every now and then you find the right equilibrium, but it's hard to maintain over time. And so instead of trying to have this perfect balance between work and family, we just decided to go with integration. We want to weave it all together. We want to be with our kids in our work, and we want to be with our kids in what they're doing. And so we began to just think about how could we have a plan? We've got plans for raids. We've got plans for enforcement operations. We have contingency plans. We have backup plans. But when it came to being a dad, I didn't have a plan. And so when our daughter was born, we began to read all these books about parenting, but most of them were about like what to expect when you're expecting and how to change diapers, but not a plan of like, how do you raise kids? And we realized that the goal of parenting was not to have well-behaved children. It was to launch successful adults.
Come on.
And so we began to think about what would make this work. And so we did. We came up with these 10 ideas, these 10 rules that could guide our family that wouldn't be like just one-off things, like don't try to catch a falling knife. Like that's really good advice. But we wanted something that would apply at every phase of life, whether they're a toddler, whether they're a teenager, whether they're 20, whether they're older and taking care of me when I'm ancient.
Okay, got my pencil out. Come on. So I hope if you're listening, Get it out.
The first one was about their identity, just and their purpose. And it was all about this idea, because we're people who are trying to be followers of Jesus. So it was please God. This idea that we were created not for our own sake, but we were created for His, that we're supposed to not be building our own legacy. We are a legacy. And just getting right this idea that we're a mist, we're a vapor, we're a phantom, we're here today, gone tomorrow, frees us up from this burden of trying to be important, and instead just frees us up to the purpose that we were created to bring pleasure to Him by loving others. And we want to create a family that's trying to love our neighbors. The second was this idea of trying to make sure we're honoring the intuitive space of life, this idea of keeping particularly moms and aunts and grandmothers smiling. This idea, if we keep the ladies in our life smiling, people who are healthy, people who want the best for us, honoring their intuition. I've never gone wrong when my wife and I are in alignment. If we're together in what we're doing and she's smiling down on that decision, it's great. The third one was people are more important than stuff. This idea that if we ever have to decide between stuff or people, the default decision should be for people. And so when they were toddlers, it was like just basically learning how to share the toy. Like that relationship with your friend is more important than you getting to play with the action figures. As it comes up in later life, it's making decisions about possessions, thinking about, you know, what are we going to do with all the things we want? Are they going to serve us or are we going to serve them? But every time a big decision comes up, and what's been fun is like sometimes we'll be making a decision and my kids will turn to me and say, Dad, people are more important than stuff.
Oh, isn't that crazy? When they turn that on you, that's just cheating. Flag on the play.
But it's fun because it created a common language, a way that we could speak into this. The fourth one was speak truth in love. This idea that everything we say ought to have two tests. It needs to be true and it has to be loving. And sometimes, you know, it could be that you don't like the dinner that our friends made for us, but you're really grateful that they took the time to make it and serve it. And so my kids could say, you know what, thank you so much for preparing this dinner, even if it wasn't their favorite thing. They don't need to fib. They just need to find a way to be loving in what is true. The fifth one was one of the most challenging. It was this idea of feelings are not actions. That just because you feel something earnestly doesn't mean it directs what we do. And so we don't want to deny our feelings. We want to be honest. We want to talk about it. But when my kids were together and my daughter would cheat at Monopoly and my son wants to punch her in the nose, like he gets to be angry that she's cheating at Monopoly, but he doesn't get to punch her in the nose. Not that that ever happened.
No.
But things do come up from time to time. But learning how to be honest, how do we express our feelings, not hide them, not sweep them under the rug, but also be mature enough to understand that they don't decide what we do. And the number one thing that I've talked to folks who are in federal prisons, they didn't learn that lesson. They acted on their feelings, and they often say their actions are justified by how they felt, instead of saying, I had these feelings, and then I needed to decide what was the right action to take. Both are true at the same time. The sixth one was just know how to stop. This idea that life has limits and everything is more fun when you follow those limitations. So like when you're learning to ride a bike, it's only fun if you know how to stop. If every bike ride ends in a crash, then it's no fun riding a bike. I think it'd be true flying a plane as well. Like if you don't know how to land the plane, the flights aren't that great. So like learning life's limits, whether it's the knowing how to stop eating or stop drinking or stop working or stop gardening, whatever it is, there's a limit that should be applied and finding those limits, because it's the last kid that stops roughhousing that always gets in trouble.
Yeah, bingo.
Right? And those extra 5 seconds, just never be the last kid to stop, right?
It's the last ski run down the triple diamond.
Absolutely.
You end up in a body cast.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Rule number seven was just finish the job, the sense of work ethic, this idea that we want to finish the job. We go all the way. So we finish the sports team. We make sure that we empty the dishwasher all the way to the silverware. Like you're doing whatever your task of the day is, you need to finish. We want to be people who finish our jobs. And number eight was know your name. The sense of your identity, that you're not defined by your worst act. You're not defined by whether you got cut from the team. You're not defined if you got a bad grade. You're also not defined by your best acts. Instead, we're defined by who created us. And to know your name. So we say, you are on Team Richmond. You are our kid. We're on this together. And good or bad that come, know who you are, know whose you are. And if you know that, you can withstand the unbelievable setbacks that are to come. you're going to be able to dismiss all the lies that limit us, these things that people tell us that we're not good at, that we just anchor us forever. I remember so clearly when I was in middle school, the guidance counselor told my mom that I wasn't very smart and I shouldn't be in the college track for the high school classes. And my mom was like, no, I think we're going to put him in those classes anyway. And my mom did. But all through those next few years, I just thought I wasn't smart because I listened to what she said.
Isn't that crazy? You have like this one interaction, for good or for bad, that is that place and teasing out what they are.
Yeah.
So good that you've like had somebody in your life that spoke words of truth over you.
Absolutely. And it, you know, to let go of those negative those negative assumptions, those limitations that people have placed on you.
You did some of that as I'm thinking about it, speaking things over my kids' lives when they were like 7 or 8 years old. They're like 28 and 30 now. They still believe these things are true. They've certainly gotten a lot of affirmation of those things under our house, but to the last person, they revere the words that you spoke over them in India because you were actually doing this stuff.
You know, it's so funny you say that because I have such clear memories of your daughter playing with a young Indian kid at a rice mill when we were trying to investigate. And she's just playing little girl to little girl. And I'm just thinking about how beautiful that was and talking with them about it. But you're kind to say that I spoke kind words to them. I know that just a few years ago when my daughter was in middle school, she sat on a rock in Malibu and talked to Lindsay. And I remember thinking, Lindsay's in her 20s, and she was speaking words now to my daughter. And she may not even remember this at all, but my daughter did. She knows. It was such a moving conversation to have someone who was a little bit further on the journey of life telling her that she was worthy, that she had hope, that her dreams could come true, and that she had value. And it was a fantastic moment. I'm so grateful to Lindsay for that.
What's your next rule in the Richmond 10?
So we hit 8, know your name. Number 9 is happen to your life. And this was so important for our family. And it's not just about goal setting, because everyone talks about like have a goal for what you want to do. That's good. It's true. We should have goals. But it's really about this idea beyond goals. It's about control versus influence. There's so many things in our life that we just don't have control over. And when we think about happening to our life, it's not about controlling everything that goes on. Instead, it's about having influence about what is going to happen. We get to get out there and hustle. We get to put ourselves in the position that if things come together, good things are about to happen. So it may be that you don't want it to rain on your wedding day. But if it does rain, you know, you don't get to control the weather, but you do get to control how you respond. And the difference between a bride who's pouting and mad that it's raining on her wedding day versus one who is dancing with umbrellas is utter joy to the entire community. And so we don't get to control everything, which frees us up from the burden of having that responsibility, but we do have the responsibility to influence what's going on. And we get to speak into our lives about that. We get to set ourselves up that if everything aligns, we get to have that success. You know, so we get to take the classes, get the degrees, perfect the skills, try to develop the credentials so that if opportunity knocks, we're ready there to answer the door, ready to make that big decision, that big left turn to go into something new and take that adventure.
And then to your point, this idea of to celebrate, to approach your life with gratitude would be to the bride in the rain with the umbrella to just assume that God's doing something great for a farmer right now.
Yeah. Absolutely.
To celebrate the wins for somebody else that it didn't, it affected you, yes, but it all probably affected somebody else in a wonderful way. They've been praying as hard as you for some rain.
Our final rule is, number 10 is make wrong things right. This sense of all of this leads up to this idea that we are all called to justice, and all justice is, despite my philosophy professor in college bending himself into an intellectual pretzel trying to define what justice was, it's really quite simple. Justice is making wrong things right. It's taking big things or small things, local things or global things, and just seeing them as wrong and deciding to make them right. Whether it's picking up some litter on the side of the road and throwing it away, taking something that's wrong and making it right. It's seeing that kid at the lunch table who's isolated and going and sitting next to him. Something wrong has been made right. And for us, when we think about this idea of freedom around the world, it's seeing that human trafficking and slavery is wrong. It's fundamentally wrong. The whole world is now in agreement about this. The most accepted international political instrument is the UN's Palermo Protocol that should abolish human trafficking. We've got over 150 countries around the world that in the last 20 years have passed comprehensive statutes that say that human trafficking is wrong. We're in agreement. And so now we need to take those laws and we need to implement them. We don't need to leave them like tools in a shed that are just collecting dust. We need to take them out and build delivery systems of justice that actually bring the parchment protections of law to the people they were intended to protect. And that is taking something wrong and making it right. That is what we're all called to do in whatever sphere we're in. And so I think this whole journey for our family, as we think about trafficking, the same 10 rules that kind of are guiding our family have also been guiding our work about thinking this is the way we need to do it. We need to speak truth and love to survivors. We need to let them know that they are not defined by their worst acts or what abuse they've suffered, that they have a future, that they have a hope. We can speak the same truth to traffickers, that they're not defined by their worst acts, that they could have a future too. We may need to put them in jail for a while. I'm okay with that. We need to make sure they can't hurt anybody else, but they have a future. It's about thinking about how we finish the job. We don't just start with a passion and say we want freedom for people, but we're going to go all the way to the end. We're going to make sure that we finish this job. Many start and few finish, and I think we need more finishers in the world. We need more people who aren't just going to explain why things are hard. We have enough of those. The world's just not in desperate need of intelligent people to tell us why things are difficult. We need more people who are actually going to go do the difficult things and get the job done.
There's these moments that we all share with the people that we love the most. I remember one of those moments in Malibu together. There was a cord that we took, and if you light each end of this nylon cord, it kind of becomes molten for a second, and then you can put it around somebody's wrist and squish it together. I have no fingerprints, because then you have to like flatten out the molten part or like just catch on everything. And so there was a moment that you and I had up at Malibu and just years and years ago where we did that. And fast forward to a year or two ago, and there's a note that I get, and that you're going to be sworn in as the ambassador to Earth for everything you've been talking about. It's way more than just human trafficking. It's your kindness and your what you bring. And so there was a little ceremony, and so as you're being sworn in at the State Department and all this, everybody's just popping with pride. And I happen to be sitting over by this little table. I didn't know that's where you were going to sign, and they'd put the wax stamp and everything. You walked over and you hiked up your shirt sleeve a little bit to show me like the little cord. And that was just such a moment of kindness. Like, you had bigger things going on in that room at that moment. I mean, your family was there, your friends were there, some pretty important people were there. And I just think that the small act of kindness, that moment where you just like pulled the shirt up just for a moment, just to say like, man, we're in this. And I just want to thank you. It's for those of you that are listening, you don't need to get the audiobook. You just got the audiobook. I think you got to write that book. I hope that when you have a moment to breathe, and I'm just so proud of you, John, and what you're doing for the world. We are so fortunate to get you representing us in beautiful places. I hope it's many, many years. But what I hope even further is this beautiful family of yours continues to grow and then infect and inspire so many other people with these 10 rules and the 15 other ones they come up with. I just wish you just so much grace and love and just good fortune as you go forward with this message.
Well, I'm so grateful for your friendship. And it meant so much that you would fly all the way to Washington, D.C. for that swearing in. You know, I remember it so clearly when we sat after this official swearing in ceremony. I had to sit down at that little desk and sign my documents. And you actually reached your arm over the rope line. Security was getting really nervous. Secretary Pompeo was standing right there. He wasn't sure what was about to happen. And you fist bumped me with the explosion going behind it. Absolutely memorable. It meant so much because I never anticipated that I get a chance to serve in this current role as the U.S. ambassador to monitor and combat trafficking in persons. I have known the prior ambassadors. I've always admired the work of the State Department. I know that in 2000, when they created this office and this position as the highest position in the U.S. government on trafficking, I never thought in the world I'd get to serve in that role. There's so many other worthy people. And so when I got a call about doing that, I know that I reached out to you and got your advice and counsel about, is this something that you would advise? And the chance to lead out on U.S. foreign policy, a chance to bring American values about freedom to every country in the world, to say that we want to do something dramatic, to lead on this effort to make sure that people are free. And to get a chance to now also, in addition to our global efforts, to get to support the coordination of U.S. efforts here domestically. It's just an incredible honor. It's a great group of people in the office. I'm inspired every day by their work and their example. And so each day that we get to sit in this office and serve in this capacity, we want to do it, want to be faithfully present each day. And I'm just glad to have your friendship as we go through this.
I'm just glad we're doing this. And people will... have all kinds of different opinions about the things going on, who's making them happen, all that. And I'm actually feeling like that's such a noisy room. I'm not spending any time in it. But what makes me happy, putting aside all the other crazy stuff going on, I just know there's a man of a tremendous integrity. He's a dad. He's a husband. He's a guy that talks to his kids about 10 rules. And you're willing to take your time away from all the other things you got going on to come sit down and say, let's talk about important stuff, about like your name matters. And let's talk about these things that would guide us. So thank you so much, John. I love you. And you have been a devoted friend for decades, and I'm looking forward to for decades more.
I hope so. I've valued your friendship for years, love your example, and you've just had such a big impact on my life and on my family. I would love the way you love my kids, whether it's giving them 5-pound gummy bears or throwing them off a cliff. Like, you have just brought tremendous, tremendous joy.
I thought
joy.
You'd forgotten about that. Maybe the statute of limitations had run. It just seemed like such a great idea at the time. But if you're listening, here's the important part. We get to eavesdrop on each other's conversations, but the important part happens next. Is there a note that you've taken? Is there something that you heard John say that you go like, actually, I want to bring that back to my family? Or maybe riff on it like great jazz. You'll just hear something, play in the key of Jesus if that's for you. If it isn't, play it in the key of love. But to say, are there important next steps that I can take? Are there important things that I can do with my family or the people that I love the most, or a boyfriend or a girlfriend or somebody that is where the relationship's been strained? This is a next courageous step for me. And that's where it gets good, where we apply it. So go back to the beginning, listen to it if you miss some of the input from John. But I always love to bring you folks that are my teachers, and you just heard from one of them. So thanks for listening, you guys. We love you. John, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Bob.
The most frequent questions we hear at Dream Big are actually really simple. The questions are this: how do I do it? How do I focus on my ambitions and bring them to life? How do I reorganize everything and move towards these dreams that are inside me? That's what Dream Big is all about. And we want to give you an actual resource that you can use so that you can move from your ideas and your ambitions to reality. So go to the link in the show notes, download a really simple workbook that you can use today. All right, something that stuck out to me in your conversation, Bob, John is so clear, not only in his own life, but also to teach his kids that it's not about you. And a lot of people would say that, but he is literally teaching that to his kids by the choices that he makes.
Yeah, and there's something about humble voices. They just travel further in the world. And as you've just heard, John is a humble voice, but he's resolute too. He knows who he is. He knows what he wants, and he's decided what he's going to do about it. And so as you're thinking about your world, it isn't perhaps going across an ocean to combat trafficking, but to say, who am I? What is it that I want? And then what am I going to do about it? And then just repeat, repeat, repeat. So start with something small. Start with something not in a foreign country. Start across the street. Start in your own home to say, I'm going to combat some apathy here. I'm going to combat some things in my life. And the way that you impact the world is you change your world, and you start under your roof, and you start with the friends that you've got. So thank you so much much for listening. Thanks for diving in to another podcast. And now go write some of your own stories. Take note during this time of the things that are happening in you, through you, and around you. And I'll tell you, man, the world needs to hear that from you. All right. So long. I'll see you soon.